Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. So what happens when a piano tuner is called in to repair an heirloom piano that hasn't been played in years?
And she starts playing the piano, and her son broke down in tears and started crying. I couldn't help but cry after that. He said she hasn't touched that piano since his grandfather died.
And in Virginia, we'll meet Wayne Henderson, who's been making guitars for 50 years.
I've made 600 and some guitars, you know, just pretty much one at a time by hand. And I still get just about as excited when I string up a guitar now as I did the first one I ever strung up.
And what keeps some West Virginia musicians going despite all odds?
It might not give them any money. It might not give them any fame. But they're doing it for the love of the craft and also for the brotherhood or sisterhood or companionship that comes from playing your heart out on stage.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. For those of you listening to our show for the first time, welcome. For those of you who have been with us a little longer, thanks for continuing to support our program. Today, we're taking a journey to find out more about the Appalachian music scene. Music of all kinds has been bringing families, friends, and communities together for centuries. But melodies and music often mean so much more for folks. A deeper connection with themselves, their community, and each other. We'll hear about how people are making money, passing down traditions, finding hope, and much more through the magical world of music. We'll start down in Rugby, Virginia, where we found the famous Henderson Guitars Workshop. This is the place where the instruments were made for legends like Doc Watson and Eric Clapton. Wayne Henderson of Henderson Guitars has crafted these top-notch instruments for 50 years. It's such a careful craft that he only makes about 20 instruments a year. Now Wayne's daughter Jane is working with her dad to pay off law school loans. Although she once thought she would become an environmental lawyer, she's now hoping to carve out her own place in the luthier community, but with her own style. She hopes to blend old technique with environmentally friendly practices. American Roots host Nick Spitzer spent some time in the Henderson Instrument Workshop right here in Appalachia back in 2014, and he brings us this story.
Wayne Henderson's grandfather and father were woodworkers who made everything from caskets to cabinets. Known as one of America's greatest luthiers, Wayne has made Henderson guitars for artists ranging from Ricky Skaggs to Eric Clapton. The waiting list for instruments is years long. Wayne's daughter, Elizabeth Jane Henderson, grew up mostly in Roanoke, Virginia, with her artist mother, who encouraged her to create things from Christmas cards to small toys and gifts. But Jane used to get frustrated visiting her father at his shop in Rugby.
I've always had a lot of people hang out in the shop. People like to do that. Everybody from the neighbor down the road to Doc Watson was his favorite hanging out place here, you know. And I think that would get on Jane's nerves.
Well, I didn't want to stand in line like everyone else. You know, I wanted to be more special than the general loafer. I think that was why I would leave, because she's like, no, I'm not going to stand in this line, you know, to visit with my own dad. So I'm going to go play outside till he's done with the general loafers and then.
But now you're making instruments for the general loafers,
yes,
and the special loafers too.
But it's nice because I have a purpose to be in here. You know, no one can say, what are you doing in here?
What about the hand skills? How'd you get the hand skills and the vision to do this stuff?
I think that's my mom. I've got to say, she has always encouraged me to be creative, always. And she's an amazing artist herself. And she's made instruments too, jewelry. She makes everything. So she would always encourage me to use my hands and make all kinds of things.
But isn't it kind of gutsy or difficult to come into Dad's world when Dad is like a nationally and internationally known craftsman and musician?
I guess if I were bad at it. But it turns out, I mean, I love it and I like to work with my hands so much that, you know, I didn't make a humongous mess. I mean, I mess things up all the time. But I try and fix it before he comes in. You know, I have the early shift. He sleeps until, you know, noon and stays up working till 4 in the morning. And if he doesn't notice that I've fixed something, then that's my test. See if I did something right.
What are you working on now over here?
These are the tops to my three ukuleles that I'm working on. I'm putting in the sound hole inlay. So I've got to put a piece of wood strips and then and a piece of Teflon that will eventually come out, and then I'll put pearl in there where the Teflon used to be.
Now, what got you into ukuleles?
I have really small hands. And I'm a small girl, and I don't like dreadnought-sized guitars, and small guitars are what I love. And I was thinking one day, hey, wonder if I can make a ukulele. My dad's made a few, and I love making them, and I like playing them, too. I can play them a lot more easily than I can guitars. And they're a good way to learn, too, I think, because they're a little smaller. They take a bit less time, and I like that I can experiment with different types of wood. I like to use woods that are sustainable, and I've been trying new and different materials when I can. And this is some blistered maple.
God, it's beautiful. And that dark kind of world pattern's amazing.
Yeah, it looks sort of like it's boiling. You could fall into it. I love that. And each piece of wood I choose, I like to have a really strong grain or something to speak to me about it. So I tap on it to sort of hear and get a feel of what it will sound like, but it's hard to tell. And, you know, because I'm using different things that aren't the traditional stuff, you know, that this maple has a really nice, mellow, sort of laid back. I feel like it really matches the idea of the ukulele and how it's just sort of laid back and happy.
What have you learned in watching her learn?
Well, you know, I try to teach her the way I do things, but she does some things her own ways, you know, and she figures out her own little tricks that I catch on to myself sometimes. And since she's not a musician, she don't play a lot, I've always, the hardest thing probably to teach is to listen to a piece of wood and hear the tone and the pitch. What we all, our instrument makers talk about tap tuning their wood, and that means you tap on it and listen to the tone it has. And you figure out what tone that is and what you think you need. Come over here one day, she had one of these newfangled tuners, these snark tuners, and she'd tap that thing on her guitar top, and that thing reads out right exactly what it is, and, you know, electronically, and probably does even better than my ear does, you know. And when your top resonates to a perfect C chord or C sharp or D, is right close to the middle of the scale, and I got to noticing when she does that, it's exactly the right size and the right shape, like what I do them, you know, and everything. And so that was a pretty cool thing she came up with. I use myself now.
When did you make your first guitar?
I made it in 2009. I think I helped my dad make one. And is because I had a lot of student loans, and I was wondering if he would make me a guitar to help me pay him down. He said that he would give me the materials, but I had to make it. And I thought, oh man, I'll do it, I guess, and just get through it. But I loved it so much, and it was such an amazing time to get to spend with my dad that I never got to do when I was younger, because he's always in here, and I never wanted to be. I didn't realize that it was such an awesome thing to do. It was really fun. So I made another one, and helped him make another one with his name on it. And then my first one with my name on it is, I made it for the organization that I was working for. I was working for an environmental nonprofit in Asheville at the time. And I convinced them if I made a guitar and donated all the proceeds to them, you know, I would get to go make a guitar. And I was thinking, wait a second, because I probably maybe should be doing this as my job if I'm trying to trick them into letting me go to work, you know, in the guitar shop. I am proud of my environmental background and what I've learned, you know, at Vermont Law School. They're incredible, and I learned a lot, and I'm hoping to weave some of that into his techniques and the way that he's taught me how to construct a guitar. I want to do it in the most sustainable way I can, and that's trial and error for me.
The woods that I've used for years and years, and stuff like Brazilian rosewood and mahoganies from South America and stuff like that are getting scarcer and scarcer all the time, and some of them it's almost illegal to even use them now. And I'm sort of excited to hear when she makes a guitar out of ash, which I always thought made baseball bats was the best thing. But she's made a couple of instruments out of that that sound fantastic.
I've made several out of white oak as well. And I made one for Doc Watson that was out of oak. And I made another one, a dreadnought size, which I don't like to do because they're so big and my hands are small, I drop them. And this one, I felt so lucky that it was made out of oak because I definitely dropped it a couple times. And someone in the shop, oh, you busted a hole in it now. And I looked, not a ding. I was really excited. But it's interesting that when my dad was making these guitars, no, it wasn't a cool thing. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go be a luthier. I wanted a guitar and I can't afford it. You know, his was a necessity. And I think now it's a luxury.
You did say that you thought your dad was pretty cool. And it's hard for, it seems to me, the next generation in the family to ever say that somebody, their parents are cool.
Well, I guess, I mean, I know that both of my parents are pretty cool because they're different. One time someone asked me if I had trouble listening to my dad. My kids would say, no, I do it my way, I do it. But you know, I'm like, no, obviously he knows what he's doing and I will definitely listen to him because I do not know what I'm doing. And even if I did, I'd still do it his way because I know it works and I know, and I want to make him proud and I want to carry on what he's made because it's really amazing.
You know, she's got her own ways of doing things and things that'd be more modern and no doubt better. But I still enjoy working in the shop here as much as I ever did. I've made 600 and some guitars, you know, just pretty much one at a time by hand. And I still get just about as excited when I string up a guitar now as I did the first one I ever strung up. I'm sure she has that same excitement, you know, and I'm just super happy that she's going to take that up, and I hope she enjoys all this stuff as much as I have for 50 years, you know.
They're not just a guitar. They're a living thing to me, and, you know, I want to keep just making really great guitars and see where I can go with it, but I'm just going to, you know, just keep going one at a time.
Thanks to our friends at American Roots for that story featuring daughter and dad luthiers Jane and Wayne Henderson, who also played guitar in that last story. Today on our show, we're talking about how music is having an effect on Appalachian lives. It's not just guitar making that's impacting folks. Piano tuners are still in demand. For this next story, I met up with a piano tuner in southern West Virginia, Maggie Jusiel. For Maggie, piano tuning is now a part-time job, although she says there's no shortage of work. I met up with Maggie a few weeks ago as she tuned the community piano at the Athens Park in Mercer County. The piano sits under a gazebo about 50 yards from a kid's playground that was busy with a kindergarten field trip while we were there. This piano, you can't help but to notice the interesting pictures and the colors on it. So we've got pigs with wings literally flying through the air. So pigs are flying here in Athens Park. And then you mentioned when we open this up.
Yeah, there's sayings all over it. And when you open the lid, you see, "Darling, I'll stop loving you when pigs fly," which is kind of cute. And then my favorite one on this piano is, "Start by doing what's necessary, then do what's possible, and suddenly you are doing the impossible, St. Francis of Assisi." For this one, ironically, I'm just going to push on all the keys. So it's going to sound fun. Woohoo! But I want to make sure everything's working. You know, whoops. And what I'm looking for is hammers that don't return, hammers that don't go, anything sticking, anything sluggish. And I'm extremely pleased to know that I won't have to be doing any of those repairs today.
Oh, nice.
So that's good.
Maggie's been tuning pianos for about 15 years in southern West Virginia. Weighted pianos can be expensive, and Maggie wants everyone in her community to have access to this instrument, even folks who can't afford the luxury.
I think it's really nice to have a piano that people have access to. And I think people used to have more access to pianos in churches, but lately, because of random things like people stealing copper pipe and whatever, churches have had to really be locked up more, and people don't have access to free pianos like they used to. And having this piano here in this town park lets young people during the summer come and play the piano. It's kind of nice.
Maggie says there are more pianos to tune in the region than there are tuners, so there's high demand for people with her skills.
Pianos, they say pianos are dying out because of electronics, but it's not going to happen in my lifetime. The demand for the acoustic piano is still high enough that there's going to be pianos that need to be tuned for many, many years.
Well, and even the heirlooms and things like that in the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are people who do piano restorations on, you know, top-end pianos and valuable pianos, but there are people who have paid thousands of dollars to have very inexpensive pianos restored, put more money into them than what they're worth because they're an heirloom, and they want to keep grandma's piano to remind them of grandma, and they want it working. So, yeah.
But don't come to West Virginia looking to get rich tuning pianos.
When you work in an area with people who have less money, they value it more. And they may not be able to pay you what you could make in New York City and some other richer places, but the appreciation you get is beyond cost, is beyond money.
I'm sure that you've heard some really interesting stories traveling around southern West Virginia. If you have any kind of short stories that you would want to share.
I've become really close to some of my customers, and when I've lost them, it's been hard. It's like losing a family member. There's a woman, I won't give her name or town, but her husband passed away and she wouldn't play her piano, and many years went by and her grandson thought if he had the piano tuned, she might play it. And he had me come out and I tuned the piano, and this is a long story short, we went outside and he whispered to me, he didn't want her to know we were still there. He pretended we left and he said, just listen. He whispered, I'm like, okay.
And you're standing in the driveway.
I'm standing in the driveway outside with these people whispering. You know, they're keeping their voices really quiet. And we're just listening, and I'm just waiting. And she starts playing the piano. And her son broke down in tears and started crying. I couldn't help but cry after that. He said she hasn't touched that piano since his grandfather died. And he feels like this brought something back into the life of his grandmother. It brought her out. And I actually talked to him just a couple months ago. She's still playing it. He said it brought her out of a depression of losing her husband. So, yeah, it's pretty special.
Special thanks to Kip Cortez, Associate Professor of Music at Concord University, for playing the hymn songs in the park for that story. Maggie works part-time at Concord, too. There, she's working to create a traditional Appalachian music ensemble similar to the Appalachian Ensemble at Davis and Elkins College, which started 4 years ago. The first members of that music ensemble graduated this year. The Davis and Elkins program works a lot like a college sports team,
The players, in this case musicians and flatfoot dancers, earn scholarships. One of the graduates is 22-year-old Kaya Cater, who was recently featured by Rolling Stone magazine as one of the 10 new country artists you need to know. Roxy Todd has been following Kaya and her bandmates at Davison Elkins College for the past 4 years, and she brings us this glimpse of what it's been like to be paid to go to college to play old-time music.
Five years ago, Scotty Leach was living in a small town in Washington State. He played in a local contra dance band, and he loved it. But he didn't feel content.
I didn't have a plan to go to school. And I remember thinking one day, I was sitting in the house I was renting, and I felt like I was in a downward spiral. Like, my life had no meaning or purpose or direction or anything. And I thought, this is bad.
So then, a very strange thing happened. The president of a small liberal arts college in West Virginia visited and invited Scotty to attend a school with a scholarship. Jerry Milnes is a retired folklore instructor at Davison Elkins College. He and President Buck Smith recruited Scotty to help launch the Appalachian Ensemble String Band.
Scotty is just an amazing performer who could adapt to play probably just about any kind of music. And that's something really exceptional to me in a musician who can just adapt and play all kinds of music on whatever instrument they're playing. You know, several of these kids have that ability. I found Kaya Cater, who was a young black Canadian banjo player.
And he contacted me on Facebook. And I thought that it was spam because it just seemed so unbelievable that, you know, someone from West Virginia would write me this Facebook message that says, you know, are you interested in a college scholarship to be in a string band? It just seemed so far away from my world. And so I almost deleted it.
But Kaya soon realized the offer was real. Kaya and Scotty were part of the first group of D&E students who were awarded scholarships to play traditional Appalachian music. Kaya and Scotty came from far away, and they each brought very different styles to the program. A third student named Rebecca, who ended up leaving the college after a few years, was the only native West Virginian in the band that first year. The first time they ever played together as a band was in Thomas in 2012. I was there, and I remember a crowd gathered around the three young musicians as they played an informal jam.
Even through all the anxiety of, like, you know, are we going to get along as friends? Are we going to be personable to each other? You know, I think that moment was really when we realized that, like, musically, we were going to be okay.
Their sophomore year, a new group of dance students started at D&E. And in addition to West Virginia tunes, the string band learned new music that would showcase the dance students. Scotty Leach says he thinks the program will continue to grow and adapt.
I'm curious what this will be like in 10 years, you know, after several cycles of students have gone through it, what the repertoire looks like, you know. We have some Duke Ellington now. You know, Jerry would have never let us do Duke Ellington the first year.
Jerry Milnes retired a year after Scotty and Kaya started at D&E. As a folklorist of a different generation, he says the break from traditional old-time music was something that was tough for him to get used to.
You know, things move along and things change, and even traditional music changes. It's never been really static. It's changed through time, and it's always going to change. So I realize that this is a new generation and a new time, and I have to understand that.
And the ensemble style of fusion Appalachian music has helped bring a lot of attention to D&E. The college invests in the program in the same way that other schools do for athletic teams. Scholarships average about $7,000 per year, though the amount varies for each student. There are now 13 students in the Appalachian Ensemble. The students tour across Appalachia, performing at schools and festivals. It hasn't been cheap for the college, which has fewer than 900 students. The chair of the Division of Fine and Performing Arts, Tom Hackman, says the ensemble has helped the college do more outreach and branding.
I don't want to say it's paid for itself, but it has. It's been worth it, I think, from the college's standpoint. It's something unique, and a lot of small liberal arts colleges, we have to embrace our uniqueness. We have to look at, you know, these are things that we do that are different from everyone else. And I think a lot of people here on campus recognized very early on that that was the case with the Appalachian Ensemble, that nobody else was doing something exactly like this.
As for Kaya and Scotty, they both say they have a lot of bittersweet emotions this week after they played their very last performance as D&E musicians.
So I've sort of been weepy the last few days. I'm realizing that, you know, I have to leave, and I don't feel like I'm done learning everything that I need to learn, so I want to come back.
Yeah, I do love it. I'm going to be sad to go.
This summer, Scotty will be staying in West Virginia to work at the Augusta Heritage Center. After August, he's not sure what his plans will be. Kaya Cater will be touring in Canada and the United States to promote her new solo album, Ninepin. On the sleeve of the CD, Kaya says, "Thank you to Scotty Leach. We've been everywhere and back again." For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Elkins.
The holy water caught my dress, and I fell down in a holy mess. Oh, Lazarus here and Lazarus gone. Oh, Lazarus, won't you take me home? Oh, Lazarus, won't you take me home? It poured down from the
Kaya Cater's mention in Rolling Stone magazine recently categorized her as a country musician, a genre that Appalachian musicians often get labeled as, even if they identify as Americana or rock. And indie musicians without big labels often have a difficult time breaking into the national market if they're from Appalachia. So why is it so hard for Appalachian musicians to find airtime on radio stations? Well, next, we're going to hear from a young DJ who's trying to help change all that. Joni Deutsch is host of the music show A Change of Tune, which airs Saturday nights on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. This month, in honor of West Virginia Day on June 20th, Joni started a new project to feature 30 state musicians in 30 days. I asked her to join me in the studio to talk about why she's doing this series called 30 Days of Hashtag WV Music.
This project is basically a showcase, one per day, 30 interviews total for the month of June, of artists around West Virginia. Originally, this project came about because when I started A Change of Tune, my West Virginia Public Broadcasting program, about 2 years ago, I quickly noticed that West Virginia music was not very much represented in pop culture or media. We don't have as much of a scene as, say, Philadelphia or New York or London. You know, the West Virginia music is not really brought up in those descriptions as something to rival or something to listen to. And the thing is, that isn't how it should be. We have a wonderful music scene here. It just doesn't get as much attention as it deserves.
But what do you think sets West Virginia artists and musicians apart from sounds outside of the state or outside of the region?
I think we have an authenticity about our music. We, as anyone could hear on Inside Appalachia, we are a people that have gone through a lot of hardships, that we've had to build our own reputation multiple times. And even so, people still get us wrong all the time in the media and press, wherever. And we never get that positive feedback for what we do. And it's sad and it's discouraging that we can make a wonderful product, but only our immediate circle can hear it. And I think some of that has to do with the geography of the state. I mean, we are, you know, it's a bit long distance between the northern panhandle and the southern coal fields. But I think it's also the lack of marketing, the promotion, the sort of
community where everyone in West Virginia stands up for a wonderful piece of art. And so I really appreciate West Virginia music. And it's not just one genre, and it's not just one kind of person either.
Yeah, that was my next question. So one stereotype that we deal with a lot is that West Virginians are fiddles and banjos, and we have our share of fiddles and banjos, and we like our old-time music. But there's a lot of, it seems like there are a lot of other genres here. What have you found for this project, and what can people expect to hear if they tune in during the month of June?
There is no way for you to peg a genre for a certain part of the state or a person. These people I'm talking to are from Southern Coalfields. They're from Beckley, West Virginia. They're from Charleston. They're from Morgantown, Parkersburg, Martinsburg. And granted, some communities have maybe a little bit more of a distinct sound than others, but everyone, when they're raised, you know, when they're younger, they listen to gospel music. They listen to old time. They listen to folk and country. But as they grew up, they all went into different directions. You can find an R&B bass player out of Charleston, West Virginia. Then you go a few miles down the road to Huntington, and you find a great Americana rock band. You go up to Martinsburg, West Virginia, you find a kind of country-tinged folk. Morgantown, you'd go into indie alternative rock. But you also find any other genre in those cities, like Ona out of Huntington. The first interview was with a man, a 30-something-year-old out of Huntington named Ian Thornton. And Ian has been playing music in Huntington for years.
The things I said to you, those nights you put me through, well, something's gotta save me better. This ain't what.
And now he's the founder and creator of the Huntington Music and Arts Festival, which is in its 7th year right now, that cultivates a local music scene in Huntington for a week. Started off as like a day or two, and now it's a full long week of art and music appreciation. And now he's also the creator of a booking and management company, which is another consideration for West Virginia, is that maybe people don't know about us because we don't promote our music as much, or we don't know about it. And I think that's what's interesting about the state, is that you can't stereotype it with its music. You can try to and say that we're nothing more than shoeless, banjo-loving, toothless individuals, which is totally false. Although I do like having my shoes off occasionally.
Me too.
And you can't do that, though. We're more than that.
Nowadays, we hear a lot about transition in the state of West Virginia. In the media, there's a lot of talk about coal's decline. And you mentioned before that West Virginians as a people, we've often had to reestablish ourselves and sort of figure out and establish, you know, who we are. Given the circumstances that West Virginia faces currently, do you think that this program specifically could play a critical role in looking towards the future?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, the West Virginia Division of Tourism, Wild, Wonderful West Virginia, they're one of the reasons why this kind of series was started. They're doing such a great job right now showing people that West Virginia can be a place of art, of culture, of tourism, that you could want to come here because there's life and energy and music. And I think this interview series plays into that because it's showcasing the artist, the local artist, not just the name ones that come in out of town for a few hours and leave the state. These are the people that live and breathe here in West Virginia that do want to make a positive impact with their music. This series can show that we can support the arts and the entertainment industry, our own arts and entertainment industry, and really support local and give back to our own communities rather than spending it on something that's maybe not beneficial immediately to West Virginia.
That was Joni Deutsch, a DJ from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. You can discover some of these musicians by following the hashtag WVMusic, or hop on over to wvpublic.org to hear some of Joni's interviews. Up next, we head over to Kentucky, where a group of folks there are trying to revive a musical tradition that was almost lost. But first, it's time for our occasional segment, What's in a Name? This week, which Appalachian town was named after a victorious beauty pageant competitor? Was it Helen, West Virginia, Racine, Tennessee, or Ona, West Virginia? Find out after the break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So, did you guess the town that was named after a young girl who won in her local beauty pageant? If you answered Ona, West Virginia, you're right. We checked in with Max Nolte, who works at the Cabell County Public Library, when he isn't playing drums in the band Ona, to learn more about both the town and his band's name.
So apparently, when the town was first founded, there was a beauty contest, and the winner of the contest was going to determine the name of the town, and a little girl named Ona won. I grew up there. Bradley spent a lot of time there when he was growing up, and then at the time, our organist, P.J. Woodard, he grew up in Ona. Legend has it, Bradley, the lead singer, was wearing an Ona Little League baseball hat, and it struck us as a pretty funny name.
If you have your own story about Ona or know of another place in Appalachia you'd like us to explore, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Last year, my daughter's elementary school hosted an Appalachian Heritage Day. One of the activities was learning how to square dance. I can remember learning how to do this too, but I always thought of it as American heritage and something practiced long ago and far away. I mean, we didn't exactly go to community dances and square dance as a kid. We were rocking out to Naughty by Nature or New Kids on the Block, you know? But I guess it is a mountain tradition, and it got me to thinking. If we're not practicing it and passing down these traditions, what happens to them? Do they go away? I don't know if my daughter knows how to do the electric slide, but she can do the twist. There are some local groups here in West Virginia that still get together to do traditional square and even line dancing. Over the border in eastern Kentucky, some children, like 10-year-old Delatus, grew up going to local square dances in Letcher County.
It's a really fun dance that I like to do, and other people like to do. It's all sorts of different kinds of people. I've seen like little 3-year-olds go up there and dance sometimes, and I've seen like really old people too, and I just really enjoy doing it.
But in Delatus's community, the question of square dancing and its lasting legacy came into question a year ago when the Carcassonne Square Dance, one of the oldest running in the region, closed its doors, many thought for good. At that point, the community wondered if anyone was interested enough to keep this tradition alive. Delatus's mother happens to be our colleague, Kelly Haywood, over at WMMT. So Kelly set out to explore what future might be in store for the square dances her daughter grew up attending. She began by talking with a local square dance caller named Aaron Stidham, who started to teach square dancing in the local elementary school.
Ben Fink is working through the Apple Shop, and he got a grant to bring square dancing and traditional music back to Letcher County. And he came to me and asked me if I would be interested in square dancing in the school system and teaching the kids, and I said absolutely. So we are trying to work in the school system first and expose square dancing to the kids and the staff and show them what it's all about. And then eventually we're going to expand to other schools. And we've started up monthly square dances at Cowan Community Center again. And hopefully after the students see this and they practice it a few times, we can have an event where they can show off what they've learned to their family and their friends. And that will also expose it to the parents and the grandparents and things. And they will see what square dancing is all about and then come to our monthly events.
When Aaron mentioned the plan to introduce this tradition to children and getting their parents and grandparents to see what square dancing is all about, I couldn't help but wonder if it had already been lost as a tradition.
My name is Ben Fink, Creative Placemaking Project Manager at Apple Shop. traditions are things that we do because that's how life makes sense to us. Tradition isn't necessarily something that is conscious, right? People have had traditions as long as there have been people. We live in traditions. We should be aware of the traditions we're living in. And if there are traditions that are important that are under threat, then we should have intentional conversations about what are the traditions that we need to make sure remain strong. And I think if it ends up being something that we're clinging to for dear life, then we say, you know what? Traditions evolve, and there's other forms of dance that people want to do, and maybe square dancing is just a thing that we're evolving beyond, and that's great. But I have a hunch that there is a lot of energy around it, and the decline of square dancing is more about lack of funding and lack of resources than lack of energy and interest.
Many of the dances being taught came from outside of the region, and were taught with the local folk dances that were known by the school teachers who were also from outside the region. So, is square dancing even a mountain tradition at all? That's what I asked George Gibson, Knott County native, a banjo player, and a historian.
In Knott Letcher area, square dances pretty much all ended in the 1940s. According to some theories, the square dance itself probably came from the French with some English influence. At one time, there were dances at school openings, school closings. It was a common thing, and dances in the home were common. You know, people would have a bean string, and the neighbors would come in and have a square dance. Carpentersville actually was started back up in the 60s. Someone who was working as a VISTA volunteer or one of the volunteers that came in here during that time. So there was a break from the late 30s or 40s, early 60s when Carpentersville was started back up.
In Susan Ike Spalding's book, Appalachian Dance, she quotes local store owners, Joe and Gaynell Begley, as saying that the effort to maintain a rich and enduring public life in the area requires preserving and strengthening not only the physical community, but the shared sense of common history, cultural identity, and overlapping social relationships that is the essence of community. In short, when times are tough, we should gather around common threads, the familiar things. But was square dancing really the common thread of that community? Or is it just a dance some outsiders decided to rally people around? And that brings me back to our current revival. Ben Fink isn't from Appalachia. Appleshop hired Ben as the administrator for the grant that looks at possibilities for economic growth that can come from utilizing local arts and cultural resources as a means of organizing our communities around a positive economic transition.
I am from the north. I spent a long time in New Jersey, and I learned to square dance in New Jersey. There is something that is really special about square dancing and the other forms of dancing like it. Popular traditional dancing that you don't have to be a dancer to do, and you can learn right when you come, and anybody can get up for. Don't even take me to the club because I'll just embarrass you, but I can get up and square dance. Why? Because you learn what to do, and you're doing it with each other, and you're exploring it with each other, and I think that is really, really powerful. And there's people well outside Letcher County, you know, square dancing and contra dancing and all these forms like this. These are popular nationwide. I can't tell you exactly what form they're gonna survive in, but then as long as we keep working together and building the culture and the economy of the region more generally, it's gonna survive one way or the other. I don't believe in preservation for preservation's sake. At the same time, I also don't believe that just because something looks a certain way at this moment means that's necessarily the way it is. Right now, it looks like there are a lot of jobs being lost in Letcher County, and with the coal industry pulling out, that means the economic future looks really, really bleak. That means everybody should leave, and we got no hope. Well, clearly that's not what a lot of people believe. Clearly that's not what I believe. Clearly that's not what a lot of the people, pretty much everybody involved in the Culture Hub believes. Just because something looks a certain way right now doesn't mean it's going to be that way in the future, and doesn't mean we can't make it different. There is a lot of energy around a lot of different cultural and economic activity. And there's a lot of energy around square dancing.
It seems Ben isn't much different from the Appalachian Volunteers and Vistas, and before them, the settlement school teachers, who came in to encourage us to pick back up and embrace our unique identity. Still, I can't feel convinced that it is square dancing that is our unique tradition, and not simply gathering as a community around dancing and music as a means to socialize and support one another. For as circular dances evolved to square dancing, waltzing and the Charleston were also being done in the mountains. The dances my grandmothers told me of were the jitterbug and the twist, not square dancing. As old-time music begat bluegrass and bluegrass begat country music and so on, why hasn't square dancing been left to do what the community wants it to do? Do we need outside permission to get excited simply because they find it interesting, useful, or romantic? Does that make it more important to us because it wasn't just us who enjoyed it? Is our culture a commodity? All I can say is that I'm interested to see what happens when the grant period ends and the communities take this on without Ben to organize them. For now, though, I'll let the people decide if this is where we should put our efforts. There's no harm in learning to dance. For WMMT, this is Kelly Haywood.
Douglas.
Oh, and did you square dance?
Yeah.
What was your favorite part?
Having fun.
Having fun. That's good. That's what it's for.
And since that story first aired, hundreds of people attended Carcazones' Welcome Back Dance in May. The band that played was multi-generational Lee Sexton, who's almost 90 years old, and the youngest musician was 17 years old.
Like a small boat on the ocean, sending big waves into motion, like how a single word can make a heart open. I might only have one match, but I can make an explosion.
Music can do a lot of things for people. This song by Rachel Platten was my theme song for a little while, when I had to convince myself that I still had fight left in me. And of course, there's nothing like a good church hymn. Do you have a favorite artist or song that helps you get through tough times? Where's your favorite open mic spot to share your new tunes? And what has music done for you? How do you remember the traditions that have worked in the past, but also give young people a chance to help move us forward? Send us a tweet at InAppalachia and use the hashtag MyAppalachia. By the way, do you know of an artist who plays traditional Appalachian music who deserves to be recognized? Nominations are now open for the 2017 National Endowment for the Arts National Heritage Fellowships, the country's highest honor for a traditional artist. Recipients went up to $25,000. West Virginia has had 3 National Heritage Fellows in the history of the award. Kentucky has had 5 fellows, compared with over a dozen artists who've received the honor in most states. So if you know of a traditional artist worthy of receiving a National Heritage Fellowship, head over to our website at wvpublic.org to find a link where you could submit an application. But don't wait. Nominations are due by July 25th. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inset Appalachia this week from American Roots and WMMT. Music in today's show was provided by the Hillbilly Gypsies, Dinosaur Burps, Kip Cortez, Doc Watson, Ona, Rachel Platten, and AC30. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. Our assistant producer this summer is Caitlin Campbell. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.